Patsy Montana and Poncho Pony. So this is the third broadcast of Radio Free Erica from Basin, Montana, and I'm sitting here with the lovely Barbara Weisberger and the equally lovely Eric Moe. Shall we all talk together?
We're both here.
Okay, great. Do you want a more comfortable chair? You can get the one that's down there in the kitchen. So I don't need these. So Eric, I have to admit I'm a little nervous to talk to you because I feel like I'm out of my element with music. But Eric Moe is here. He's another one of the artists in residence, and I know Eric and Barbara from before Basin, Montana life, but so if I seem too familiar, maybe that's or if I take things for granted. But Eric is a composer and a musician, and I asked them both to come talk about their work. And Barbara, I'll give you one of these. Will be mono, but.
I didn't write Poncho Pony.
Well, I was wondering actually one of my questions is if there are sounds that you just don't like. You know, like if there's something, I don't know if that's like asking a visual artist if there's things they don't like to look at, which is maybe dumb. But.
No, there's some, I do have a little trouble with country western.
You do?
But just about every other kind of music, I find something to admire.
Uh-huh. And does country western include contemporary as well as like vintage, or it doesn't matter?
It It sort of doesn't matter. Let me just say my appreciation of it is a little slower than it hasn't yet caught up with me.
It's surprising to me because I know the Western landscape is so important to you. So I don't, not that the music and landscape have to go together, but...
Well, I have a theory that country and Western music, especially now, is not really, doesn't really have anything to do with anything much other than what somebody thinks is going to be a big hit
in pop music.
Certain parts of the country.
Like a lot of commercial music.
Yeah. We stopped somewhere along the way on our drive here and they had the country music television station play. And it was, I couldn't pay attention to anything else except for that because it was so culturally other and glossy and it was beer drinking, but everybody's clean and riding around in clean pickup trucks and it was interesting.
Yeah, I mean, there used to be some individuality in country, which is, you know, I mean, you had a singer, singers were prized for the distinctiveness of their sound, and now that all seems to be, the idea is to cultivate a blandness and a similarity.
Well, I liked Miss Montana's song. What was her name?
Patsy Montana. Yeah. There's a fun section on her in this yodeling book, but she was one of the first female yodelers, country western yodelers.
Was she from Montana?
No, she wasn't, but the next person in the book, Janet McBride, she is from Montana, so I'm going to put her on later. my grandfather was a yodeler in a country, like he played country music, and I grew up with a lot of country music, so I hated it for a period of, like, adolescence, but now I think it's really part of...
So I just need another 10 years.
You have to go through the hate phase first before you get to the love phase.
Exactly. Well, I don't know that you ever have to love it, but it was one of the questions I was thinking of. So I told you earlier that I just watched your Tristan. DVD last night, and I feel like it's going to take me days of sleeping and dreaming it to process it. But how did you come to that story?
Well, I was looking. I like David Foster Wallace's writing a lot, and I had a friend of mine suggested it to him to me as somebody that I might enjoy reading, and indeed I did. And I read a collection of stories called Brief Interviews with Hideous Men.
Mm-hmm.
And that story, the story Tristan, I sold Sissy Gnarr to Echo, sort of leapt out at me as something that I could turn into. There'd be an enormously rich thing to set to music. And so I did.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had the perfect singer for it who was looking for a piece for me anyway. And so it all went together.
So how does that work if you want to set someone else's text to music? Can you just do it, or do you...
No, you get permission. which is usually a long... I mean, if it's a living... If it's not a public domain text, then you have to get permission. And that's usually... can take quite a while. And this was no exception. David Foster Wallace gave his permission immediately, but then he said, but I'm not really the guy that you need to get the permission from. You have to talk to my agent.
Yeah, which is kind of weird.
And it was fine, there was a contract, and the whole thing took a year, probably, from start to finish, just until all of the things were ironed out.
Administrative.
Yeah, no, I didn't have the heart to tell her, the agent, that, you know, I'm not going to make any money on this.
Right. Well, not immediately, at least. Yeah. I kept watching it and thinking about, Barry said you've seen it performed a few times. I was thinking about that difference between watching something like as a DVD and then watching something as a live performance. Like, I kept wondering, the woman who was singing, like, is she visible in the performance?
Yes. And she's standing right next to the screen.
Yeah.
In a white toga.
Yeah. Yeah, I was craving some of that, like that, that energy that's just in the room.
Yeah.
To just see how that informed the piece as well. Yeah, it's funny because I didn't know the whole time through whether it was fiction or whether it was truth. I mean, because there's all those pop cultural references, and it seems like...
Some of it's true, yes.
Yeah, it seems very possible, and I had to keep restraining myself to not, like, stop the DVD and start Google searching all these names and stuff, but I did. I was like, I need to finish this first.
Yeah, no, those are real. The story is sort of a mixture of 1980s television meets Grand Opera.
Yeah.
I think I said somewhere in my program notes, Brady Bunch goes to the ring. And in fact, the Brady Bunch is one of the shows that's referenced in there.
Yeah, all those family shows, family ties, all those. And I thought, is this really true? Is one person responsible for all of those programs?
Well, I think Norman Lear had a lot to do with some of those anyway, and then in the story, he's replaced by the character of Agon M. Nahr. It's certainly heavily invested with having some simulacra of reality.
It absolutely. Was that the first, because I was reading at your website, ericmoe.net, also about reading some of the other press releases, and one of them was talking about that you were ready to start working on a narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so I assume that's from before doing this piece, a narrative drama or...
I've been concerned with musical narrative.
Yeah.
Which has somewhat different rules from verbal narrative for a very long time. It's really interesting to play off a musical narrative against a verbal narrative. And because they do have different rules, music makes its points by repetition, and storytelling generally doesn't repeat things. Your impulse there, at least in contemporary times, is moving the plot along, developing character, things. And if you just sit around repeating things, then that doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
But for music, the pattern itself is the exciting thing. And then when you change the pattern, that's where the drama is. So it's a different, whole different animal to play with. So I really like the way they go to, really like playing with them, as well as just using the music to make another layer of meaning for any given text or story.
It's interesting, that idea of repetition. I've been thinking about it with fairy tales, actually, as something that, and I've never thought about it then as, you think about it with pattern and visual, I think about it. But it's interesting to think about it then musically also.
Yeah.
Like, to make that link. It's obvious, I guess, but...
Well, I was particularly interested in fairy tales, actually, at one time, because, and still I am, because there's sort of a construct, there's a model for what a good fairy tale has in it, and every fairy tale has some or all of these elements in it. Actually, some guy made a study of it and found all of these semiological elements that are possessed, that are present in every fairy tale. And so it seems to me that more than almost anything else is an example of a codified genre that you can then play with and have some fun with narratively, despite the similarities from tale to tale. But the piece I'm working on now, in fact, I was looking at this stuff again because I'm trying to write a piece that will have it's an instrumental piece, but it's still going to have a narrative of, or a sort of a crypto narrative of a superhero thing, which, and superheroes are very much like fairy tale characters in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
So I was sort of looking at sort of general things that happen in every superhero narrative, and trying to make structure a piece around that to find a to create a narrative arc for the piece.
Mm-hmm. There seems to be, like, you seem to have such a sense of humor and like a playfulness, and that seems, that seems great, but it also seems surprising. And how do you negotiate that, and how does that, how do you feel like that propels you or places you in the world? Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Well, I always liked comedy, I think I had to listen to, as part of my job, being a composer, is you have to listen to an awful lot of very, very earnest pieces
mm-hmm.
out there. And after a while, you really get sick of it and want to do something very different.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that one of the things I like about comedy is that you can make really, really serious points
mm-hmm.
in it, within it, and they have that much more power or kaboom to them.
Mm-hmm. And how do you feel, I have no idea, sort of the musical community, or how do you feel like that's been, do you feel like you're one of few people who's working in that way, or do you feel like there's...
I don't think there are a lot of people
uh-huh.
trying to do what I'm doing. Which is nice, because, there are a lot of people writing music in the world.
Right.
A few too many, right? But, so.
<That's> far, right?
Never mind. So because I feel like sometimes, well, Barbara, you have a lot of humor in your work, too.
Mm-hmm.
And do you feel like that opens more doors, not for yourself or not within yourself, but do you feel like, do you know what I'm trying to say? Do you feel like it's something that then is used dismissively against you, either of you, or that it's used in an opening sort of way, or both, or
works both ways. I certainly had the dismissive aspect of it.
I think it's a little different in music and visual art, because there are a lot of artists that are doing cartoon inspired work right now, so-called not cartoon artists, but I think it's different, like in new classical music or
mm-hmm.
however you categorize
mm-hmm.
what you're doing. But
nobody wants to laugh.
Mm-hmm. Or they don't feel like they have the permission to.
They're not supposed
yeah.
to be laughing.
But I think I got interested in doing that because I felt like it does give you a certain license to be I think you can deal with, you can treat very serious subjects in a less heavy-handed way, let's say, if you're doing work that mm-hmm. is hopefully funny to people other than you. I think in visual art and just in visual practices like cartoons, comics, there's like a whole sort of satirical tradition that, I'm hoping to tap into. And that, so I think, in addition to treating serious subjects, you can also sort of take a sort of socially critical look at things
but also in maybe not such a heavy-handed way. Or
yeah.
So, I mean, I think that's part of the appeal of doing work like that for me.
Right. And then also, I guess, like you said, the visual arts has a history, or there's mm-hmm. a history that you can sort of place yourself within, mm-hmm. which I don't know the history of music, especially mm-hmm. classical music, mm-hmm. but it seems like, yeah, there's less.
Oh, there's a tradition of
comic opera.
Yeah, not just comic opera, but there are pretty lighthearted instrumental pieces. It's just, in the 20th century isn't rich with examples of it.
Uh-huh.
The 17th, 18th, 19th centuries all have tons of examples.
That's interesting. Why do you think that is?
I think it's probably what happened when music moved into a concert hall and out of people's living rooms and out of the aristocracy's salons, and it became in a form of mass entertainment in a funny way. I haven't really pondered the issue deeply, so I don't really. I'm likely to get myself in trouble with music historians.
This is not about getting in trouble. This is about learning and introductions. Yeah, I know it seems really interesting, though. I mean, because your work to me, and again, I think I know. I'm learning more about writing as a process than a medium, but like music is still, it's still something very far away. So, but your work seems really eclectic, I guess, but mm-hmm. also, but just also like sort of in its own orbit compared to anything else. Like I can't mm-hmm. place it with anything else.
Yeah,
like directly.
Right. Well, there aren't a lot of pieces that combines Stravinsky with 1980s television sitcom theme songs.
Right.
For
right.
I think I've cornered the market on that.
All right. So, how do you feel, both of you? Well, so I introduced Eric, was it introduced? Barbara Weisberger as well, which I have to say I'm very excited, Barbara, that you are the first person that's been on both the New York Radio Free Erica and the Base in Montana Radio Free Erica interview.
What an honor.
So you can listen to Barbara's archived program from 2 years ago and compare to like what is now. But Barbara is also in residence here. She's a painter, but you call them drawings, but mm-hmm. I keep calling them paintings.
Yeah, they're sort of on that edge.
And you also have a website, barbaraweisberger.net,
mm-hmm.
and we're linked to it on the radio website. But both of you, one of the questions I wanted to ask is landscape like influence of place in your work, and since Montana is a place that you guys return to mm-hmm. and are drawn to, if you can talk about that.
Well, I think people ask, I mean, that's a question people ask a lot. I don't know if they've asked you that since you've been here.
I think it's really, like, I'm doing some of this, so it's like, let's talk about the place. Like,
I've noticed that when I've had open studios here, people that are from here that have come through have really wanted to ask about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it is like a really remarkable landscape. So, I mean, I think it's subtle, and I'm sure this is something you've given some thought to since you've been here. But, I told you the other day, I was thinking about this, like, different ways that I think it has kind of crept into the work. The first way is, since I've been making drawings of hamburgers, something that people asked me here a couple years ago when I had an open studio and I had some hamburger drawings up was, you know, if I was influenced by all the cattle in the area.
It's a funny question,
but the first is like, well, no, because you know, actually, honestly, the chronology is I started doing those drawings right before a residency here. Mm-hmm. But then, since then, first of all, it makes kind of a good story that, yes, it is the ranching was the influence. But since I have been thinking a lot about the food industry and food processing and all of that, that in a certain way, I can make the connection to, you know, seeing all the cattle ranching, especially the more I kind of think and learn about, you know, food processing. And then I am thinking about the hamburgers that, you know, a kind of great American icon. So that's one thing. And I think there's something also about the colors of the place that have kind of crept in that I've kind of noticed after the fact. It's not like been an intentional. But there have been different cycles of drawings where the, specifically the color of the mountains, we were talking about this the other day, the sort of pinkish undertones and then the green landscape, that actually has kind of crept in at different times into my palette. It's kind of funny thing. I mean, you know, you look at something a lot, kind of gets in there. So, I mean, that's kind of a formal thing. But and then the other thing is that a piece that I'm working on right now in the studio, which is a corner piece, which you saw the other day, which is a sort of based on a mirrored symmetry, which it came out of a couple of ideas, but one of the references or one of the things I was thinking about was when we go backpacking, go up to these high mountain lakes, on the lakes when there are a lot of rocks and trees and such and different forms along the shoreline, you get that at certain times of the day when you have the reflection of all that in the lake, there's kind of a Rorschach all around the perimeter of the lake, and which is really, I mean, it's kind of cool looking. And so that idea of the Rorschach and the mirror and setting the piece in the corner, that has a link to that effect that I've seen here a lot. Which, you know, you can see anywhere where there's water with a shoreline, but it just so happens it's something that I think, especially because going hiking or backpacking here, you know, it is so quiet and things are slow. Or it's not quiet, but it's, you know, like nature sounds as opposed to the urban sounds I'm used to. So it is contemplative, and, you know, you do sort of spend a lot of time thinking about, you know, all of these visual effects that you're seeing. So that's my list right now of the way it's crept in. Yeah.
And then I guess also for both of you, then I would look at, in terms of the urban landscape, because you guys are both from the urban landscape from New York and Pittsburgh and San Francisco, and both basin and that urban.
Well, people, actually with Tri-Stan, people always say, you put that in Montana?
Yeah.
The whole thing is set in L.A. or in Southern California, the fluorescent basin of Southern California.
Yeah, in medieval, like it took me a really long time to get the medieval, like pre-cable.
Yeah, BC is before cable. So, no, it's an odd thing. I look at urban spaces as landscapes too, and I mean, you know, I think of them also as acoustic landscapes, and that's primarily what I've been moved to take tape recorders around like Washington Square Park in New York and other parts of the city just to try to sort of capture these, you know, sort of miraculous things that come as about as juxtapositions of things, juxtapositions of sounds, that are part of what we're all, that's happening to us every day, but we're not so aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
And here, as Barbara says, the pace is a little slower, which means you get to assemble your own.
A little quieter. You were on when we went for that sort of a walk the other day with the rocks. I thought that was kind of nice. Like that one time you were so bored in the landscape that you discovered all the different sounds and pitches of rocks and playing in that way.
Yeah, you can make music out of about the most basic material you could imagine.
Right, it's sort of like the musical Andy Goldsworthy or something. Right. Like, that would be really cool, actually. I could see you collaborating with him. You could soon have some connections.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah. And then Barbara, you with the urban landscape, surveillance is a repeating motif for you. And when did that begin? Or can you sort of think of how that began?
I haven't thought about that in a while because I sort of dropped it for a while and now it's making a emergence. I sort of hate to say this, but I think I started using the surveillance imagery after September 11th. I didn't really think of that in the context so much of like an urban landscape, even though, I mean, you can't help but notice surveillance cameras in every urban space. I thought about those a lot, or I think about those a lot, also as a kind of psychological, like more of the way surveillance is internalized and sort of more of like a psychological resonance, I think, with it. I like the relevance of it and the connection that you can make. It is something that, you know, is so ubiquitous now. But I am sort of thinking of it as also having this kind of psychological aspect to it. So maybe that is like sort of a mental thing more than like literally thinking about sort of that like within the context of the urban scene.
Right. And the other imagery that you're working with now with the with body, like the flesh, and taking it from bodybuilding, like it's such a culture being looked at, which seems like just another extension of what you're talking about with the cameras.
I do make that connection.
Yeah, even here, like in the thrift stores and stuff, I see signs that say you're being videotaped, and people's cars now. Like it's like equipped with video surveillance, and it's kind of amazing how...
It's amazing how comfortable people are.
It's just like the places that aren't are fewer than the places that are equipped.
It's very commonplace, and just accept it, Yeah.
Well, there's not too much surveillance in the national forests.
Right.
That we know of.
Exactly.
With all those planes.
Then being somebody from an urban landscape, somehow it feels, I feel like I feel even more like I'm being watched.
Oh, really?
In some ways.
People behind the trees.
Yeah, just like somebody who knows something or some animal or,
Well, that's the small town surveillance. Everybody knows what everybody else is
doing. Exactly. Like Mark knowing that where everybody was going for lunch yesterday. But
and everybody saying to him, oh, I saw you in
But there is something about that being like in the national forest where the possibilities seem so wide open that somehow it's more vulnerable feeling than like standing between the Bank of America Chase and somebody else, you know, like somehow that's more known, and that's not so nice to think about. But I wanted to ask you, Eric, about the Tristan. I don't know why I keep wanting to call it Tristan.
Because there's a
Tristan's
big piece by Wagner.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I quote extensively.
And Tristan Shan. Okay. But if you use the full text from the story or...
I used a lot of it. Uh-huh. Yeah. I had to cut it a little bit, or the piece would have been even longer.
Right.
At 50 minutes, it's already sort of strains what you can do in a concert hall setting.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I used most of that.
Yeah,
most of the story.
It's just, it was curious to me, in terms of abstraction, like how much further abstracted it was or not, or but it sounds like not that much.
Yeah, I left. I excised, I think, very cleverly a subplot or two, which I don't think was necessary to. But I kept the main thrust of the story intact.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a big job. Listen, it occurs to me after my opening disparagement of country music that I actually, in a recent piece, I actually did write a country and western
right.
song.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Like,
which I think is actually pretty good. I mean, uh-huh. But it was a real challenge for me because I was setting it was a piece for a vocal ensemble in San Francisco named Volte. And I was setting a poem by a Brooklyn poet named Mattia Harvey. And she has a reference to a country western song in the text and has a line or two of it. So in creating the setting of it, I had to sort of make up the country western song. And the compositional challenge was to make something that sounded like it was country music, but was... at least for me, more interesting than
uh-huh.
I find a lot of country music to be.
Uh-huh.
So that was an interesting exercise.
Yeah, I'd like to hear. Is it on one of your CDs?
Not yet.
Okay.
I hope it will be someday. The name of the piece is "Oh, the Flesh is Hot, But the Heart is Cold," which is also the title of the country song.
It's a good title.
And the group sang it with the twang?
Yeah.
do you feel like your process is pretty collaborative? Like, I guess being a composer, other people are performing what you compose, but
yeah,
it
yeah.
sounds like you so work with... it sounds like there are more people involved.
Yeah, I usually try to pick people who aren't going to give me a hard time.
Well, sure.
No, I mean, in other words, I try to collaborate with people who aren't going to, so that I can always be in charge, I guess.
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry, the way I like to be.
So maybe it's less collaborative and more...
concert music by sort of its nature is collaborative because you always have to, all of your intentions are filled in through a performer.
Right.
Or that's one way of looking at it. You could also say the performer adds their own
mm-hmm.
contribution to it, which is certainly true. And since I've been on both sides of that, I know,
mm-hmm.
know what it's like. Both sides of it, sometimes at the same time when I play my own music. So there's always, there's plenty of collaboration involved anyway. And the only way around it is if you write purely electroacoustic music. And I've got a piece or two that does that, but
mm-hmm.
I'm happier when I have... it's more fun when I have a person
mm-hmm.
or people at the other end
mm-hmm.
doing it. But anyway, because of that already being built into it, I enjoy bouncing off other art forms and... people's work and other art forms, but I prefer it if I'm calling the shots.
Right.
Because music ends up tending to be looked at as a background element if you very easily.
Right.
So the idea of writing movie music, for instance, doesn't appeal to me at all. A lot of composers get very excited about the idea, but it's not something that moves me because I actually want people to listen to the music. I want the music to be primary.
Well, after I admitted my Nick Cave crush the other night, I looked, and he has actually a film that he wrote and then did the music for that just came out. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
That seems like a way, like you write it.
That's one way to do it.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm curious to hear that and also to see it. Just that you were mentioning, like working with this poet and then working with the David Foster Wallace, like it seems less solitary of a practice. Mm-hmm. I mean,
well, it's pretty damn solitary, but
right.
Yeah. Well, in that case, I was taking things that they'd already written.
Right.
And that's kind of the way I prefer to do it, and then I just make my own piece out of that. The closest thing to an actual collaboration in recent years was working with the video artist, Susie Silver, who did the
DVD
video for Tristan. And that was a case. She was wonderful to work with because she was willing to make the video as subordinate to the music and the story as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know any other video artist who would have been willing to do such a thing. But she sort of got it right away and saw that that was what was necessary.
Well, I think of just working with students with video or photographs and music. I won't let them use another person's piece of music because it is it's so powerful. Like you said, it's seen as background, but I think it's so powerful, like it's you know, I don't know, I think it's, you have to be really you have to be really savvy to be able to, like,
no, it can take over. I mean, yeah, I mean, any, it's hard to keep a balance or get the right balance in any collaboration,
or just being a person who's taking like a piece of pop music or whatever and then trying to like put your images to it.
It almost never works.
Yeah. it's the music is completely overpowering.
Well, it tends to reduce reduce the experience to one kind of thing that's very specific.
Mm-hmm. Well, it structures the time too, so it really
Exactly. Rhythm, everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you were talking about some of like taking recording in Washington Square Park and stuff, it makes me think of DJ culture, which is like, what, I don't have a smart question, but just sort of what do you think is sort of like the DJ phenomenon and mixing and that sort of like.
Oh, it's a great way to make music. I mean, it's nifty that now we've got the technology to really make that available as a tool in real time. It's terrific. I mean, like any other art form, there aren't a lot of really good people doing it.
Right.
Yeah, as far as I can tell. But, you know, with luck, the good ones will rise to the top.
All right. I'm curious, like, if it's something sort of like in the past couple of years, I've thought a lot about photography and how there's so many teenagers with just endless hours of time that now have digital cameras and computers.
Mm-hmm.
And so like there are people making really savvy images really young and maybe GarageBand or something like that is some sort of, you know, I don't know, I'm just curious.
Musically it's not quite as sophisticated. I mean, I teach computer music, so I have a fair idea of what, you know, today's youth, at least in Western Pennsylvania.
Right.
<It's meta>.
And the problem with a lot of the programs is they're commercial products and designed to appeal to as many people as possible. They're templates for how to build a piece within them that most of the people who are music with them, sort of accept unthinkingly, and then they...
Right.
I don't know, I guess it's sort of like if every slideshow or every succession of images you saw had a dissolve.
Right.
The Ken Burns effect.
Yeah,
but it does, but conversely, I mean, it's like what you're saying, like kids really, you know, can have this sense of like home production.
Right.
You know, more than just like gluing things together.
Yeah. you know, learning how to play the guitar. It's curious. But we are so much more of a visual culture that I guess inherently people are more sophisticated at a younger age, I guess, just because
you're
soaking it up.
Yeah,
sophisticated music is pretty sidelined culturally these days. I mean, it's hard to find in any genre. I mean, in jazz, in pop, in classical music, sort of the sophisticated artistic expressions tend to be marginalized as much as possible. So there are a lot of people who never come in contact with it throughout the course of their entire lives.
All right. And so, both of you, I wanted to ask who you look to, who do you like to listen to, who do you like to look at, and whether it's because of similarities or differences or just...
I'll think about that.
I was hoping you would. Well, for me, it changes a lot.
Uh-huh.
A lot of it depends on the kind of piece I'm trying to write. There are some composers that I keep going back to because they keep exciting me and giving me like great ideas, or what if I could do something like that in my piece, like Beethoven and Stravinsky, and those are probably my top two for that particular purpose. But then, like I wrote a percussion sextet recently, and I was listening to a whole lot of Jimi Hendrix, particularly his drummer Mitch Mitchell, and when I was writing that piece. And I mean, he does these incredible things on a trap set that just are really thrilling, and I wanted to try to capture some of that in a written down piece, so I was listening to an awful lot of that. But it really sort of depends on the piece.
Okay, I'm ready. I thought about it. Well, right now I'm listening to Fast Food Nation, which I'm thoroughly enjoying, and it's, I think, definitely exerting an influence on my thinking right now. And I was thinking, I've been actually thinking about like Bruegel and Bosch again, which I keep coming back to. And I, a couple years ago, the Comic Grotesque show at the Neue Gallery, did you see that?
No.
That kind of like, well, made me think about like all those Weimar artists again, and that show has really stuck with me. You know, it was a lot of like there's some Hannah Hawk and Hertzfeld collages, but also there were like some puppets from some of their theatrical things then, like political things, and that's incredibly vague, but but there were a lot of just sort of these comic grotesque paintings, really great, and paintings of grotesques, and so that's kind of what, before I came here, I had a chance to see the Nicole Eisenman show, which, did you see that?
No.
No, so that was...
I can't even... picture, like I can't picture work with the name.
Well, kind of, you could say comic grotesque,
uh-huh.
kind of satirical paintings. she just, like, she's done a lot of very cartoony drawings and paintings and, yeah, a lot of grotesque stuff and in the new one, new show. So, yeah, that's some of the stuff I've been thinking about lately.
And how about you, Eric, outside of listening, are there authors that you return to or visual artists that
Yes. I guess I read an awful lot. And I just finished this novel by Bruce Wagner called The Chrysanthemum Palace, which has a lot of postmodern layering of stuff. And I find experiences like that to be as inspiring as listening to music often for creating structure, or just getting ideas. What can I do with that? But also, especially since I've been together with Barbara, I've been seeing an awful lot of visual art that works the same way and gets me thinking about things that, and I can bring things into my work that I wouldn't otherwise. For instance, I wrote a piece last summer called Let Me Tell You About Our Specials for Patty Monson. I think I was telling you about it. It's a piece that sort of takes the point of departure, the narrative dialogue that waiters will give you throughout the course of the meal, starting with, "Hi, I'll be your server this evening," and to, you know, "have a nice night," and with everything, including my favorite, "are you still working on that?"
I feel like you meant food at first. Yeah. You're talking about a piece.
It comes up in the piece. I don't know, and it seemed to be a good metaphor for the experience of being presented, served a new piece.
The art delivery system.
I don't think I would have written that piece if I hadn't seen, some conceptual work that's of similar nature in the visual art world.
That's interesting. It makes me think of thinking about wait service. My favorite line from a waiter ever was when we were in Los Angeles once and we had just arrived from New York and we were at a restaurant and there's an actor definitely serving us and we were really excited to be talking with Mark's sister who was living in LA and we were just in this conversation and he kept asking us how we were doing and at some point we were like, "we're fine," and he said, "well, what can I do to make it great?" We all just about fell out of our chair. What can we do to make it great? Fine is fine. At least in New York.
Yep.
I have a whole other Barbara list too. Barbara, one of the questions I was thinking of, if there had been recent surprises for you in your work, and I guess, I don't know, or, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sort of. Let's see. A couple of months ago, I started doing this work that I'm working on here, which is making the collages from, it started out with from pieces from Muscle magazines with hamburger pictures that I had taken. And I had this idea So before this, I was doing the drawings of hamburgers and also drawings of grotesque figures, and I wanted to bring those together. So I had this idea to make collages that brought together the body images with the hamburger images, and then make drawings from the collages. So that's something I had been thinking about for a long time, and just started working on a couple months ago. And I guess, you know, I mean, not surprise like discovery exactly, but I guess there's been some surprise with it in that it has sort of opened some things up, working in this kind of new way. And very recently working here, I've been kind of intuitively expanding the imagery that's in them. So I guess there's been some surprise in that, and just sort of letting some other things in, and even sort of photographing some things around here and incorporating that into, I mean, funny things like the ratty old chair in the studio. So, not scenic things.
Some poppy. Some pretty poppy.
Scenic. But also ratty. So yeah, I mean, you know, as it's always nice when that happens, when you're working, when you let new ideas kind of pop out. So sort of, I guess, small surprises. Yeah.
Do you guys feel like something I've been sort of surprised about here is how vividly I've been dreaming? And I can't remember the last time, like, I wake up and I have like four full dreams that, and there seems to be like less of a break between awake and dream here, and I don't know if it's just because.
No, I think that's true for me as well. I think it's just there's less distraction. I mean, there's not much to do at night aside from going to sleep.
Yeah.
Before it's dark out.
Before it's dark out, less than the case of last night.
Well, and maybe it's less that has to be like processed so you can psychologically survive, and it's just more like just the general. I know it seems like dreams so much in the city, like it's like work or processing out like stresses, and here.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, I agree. Because you sort of get to do the large stuff that's important, but you never get around to it because you've got all this urgent crap that's taking up your time and needs to be dealt with by your subconscious.
Yeah.
I think I sleep a lot better here. It's so quiet and calm. It's like a deeper sleep.
Yeah.
So, plus you can only see the sky, you don't see the landscape from the window in our bedroom. So we call it our little James Turrell because it's like light till 10.
Yeah. Yesterday being the solstice too, yet we ended up letting Dove. He just couldn't go to sleep, and we're just like, okay, get up, you know. We were all up until it was dark, and there's something pretty amazing about how few hours of dark there are. And then I think about what the winter must
really
feel
dark.
Like.
The opposite.
Yeah, I was telling Dad
4 o'clock.
That the kids probably go to school and it's dark out, and they come home and it's dark out. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it gets dark around 4 in the winter.
Well, it's at 10, and then it starts getting light around 4:30 or 4. Now a.m. So it's like 6 hours of dark. So
9 to 3. Yeah. Up to you, right?
Yeah. Well, it's been such a treat for us to be here with you guys. I just want to say that recorded.
Yeah.
Recorded, and I feel like I'm learning all sorts of new things about process and
likewise.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us on here.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you don't have to feel like you have to go, I just ran out of all of my really good questions.
They are good.
I have this list of questions actually I can ask you for the group of the TAs that I'm working with for the summer program came up to ask the high school students that will be coming to work with us this summer, and some of them are really fun, like, would you rather get caught in the rain without an umbrella or carry an umbrella around and it never rain? Like, sort of like a philosophy of
Who came up with these questions?
Well, all of the teaching assistants and I did. Mm-hmm. So five from each of us. Mm-hmm. But I asked them, I said, oh, they're so fun. May I use them for the radio? you know, I thought for the open house it would be nice, just general questions to ask people if they didn't want to talk, but everybody was very... Mm-hmm. Very willing to talk. So do you guys have any basin or Montana things you'd like to share? I mean, you guys have a real, like, you have a sense of time, and you have 5 years of coming to Montana to work, and so it's a lot of time to go away and think about it and then come back again and then, but I don't know any.
Well, you're going to have some basinites on for some really, the real deal basin stories.
Yeah.
Trying to think.
Well, what's nice is that it's so different from our urban lives. Mm-hmm. Not that there aren't there's plenty of overlap, and there's some very sophisticated artists right here, it was an unexpected bonus for me.
And even, I think that, like, speaking of surprise, like that, like being in this little town with 200 people, and then, you know, there are like amazing jazz musicians here that you can go hear. It's just such an unexpected thing that, I think it's sort of that much greater, because who would think you'd be in an old mining town?
Yeah.
There'd be these, you know, amazing artists and people here. I mean, not that there wouldn't be.
And Eric, how do you feel like fishing, or because you're a fisher person. is there something, is just like a zen that's similar, or do you just, I don't know, I'm the kind of person who links everything together, and so sometimes I forget that not everybody does that, but...
Oh, you know, I've thought about it a lot. I do enjoy fishing, and... there's a rhythm to it. Time passes in a really different way than it does in our daily lives, and that's also true of music. It takes quite a bit of intense concentration at times, which can also be true of music. Aside from that, they don't really have much to do with each other, and that's good too.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's kind
it
of
makes
a
it
lot,
a nice complementary activity.
Yeah.
And hiking is similar in all of those respects. There's a sense of rhythm. Time moves at a different speed than it does when you're in the city doing errands, and for instance. And some intense concentration is required from time to time.
Mm-hmm. And it can get you to just focus on, like, being able to breathe.
Yeah.
If you're going uphill.
So I just feel like in the city I need to do more often. Mm-hmm. Just focusing on being able to breathe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's Joy.
Oh,
hello, Joy.
Next guest.
Well, you guys are welcome to stay or back to the ground.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks very much.
Hey, Erica.
Hi, thank you.
Back on stereo.
Thank you both. Hi, Joy.
Hi.
Joy Lewis, the residency coordinator at the Montana Artists Refuge. Thank you for coming to talk on the radio. Your mic's right here.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I was hoping you could talk a little bit about the history. You're one of the original founders of the mm-hmm. residency, and just sort of what motivated you guys to found such a place.
Mm-hmm. I think Basin seems like a really, or it seemed like a really unusual place at the time, and it had a lot of art. There were a lot, in a sense, there was some art history already here. The Weavers Guild was started in Basin, I think, in the 30s or 40s by Mary Atwater. And it seems to have been a place that people came to make art, you know, in different ways. And like I said, like as Mary started the Weavers Guild here, and also it just seemed to bring people that were artists here, craftspeople. There was a huge different mix of people when I first came in 1974, and many of us were interested in the arts and in different genres, you know, music, writing, visual art. There was a lot of people in town that were doing different things, and we had always talked about Basin as a sort of a refuge for artists, and how could we create that so that we could help people come here and do their work without sort of the everyday stuff in their lives that prevent them from doing that, mm-hmm. From making their art. So we talked about that for a long time, and finally an opportunity arose, and we were able to start it by actually some members buying into a building that I owned as well. It's actually the building that we're sitting in. Mm-hmm. And we started small, and we're in two buildings now. We still only have four spaces, but it's really kind of given a good mix to, in general, to the people that do come here.
Right. Yeah, definitely. That was something I had asked Claudia about. Like, there seems to be a real curating of, like, just who's here now. Like, it seems like a really nice synergy.
Yeah.
And, well, it seems like the town, it's interesting to hear you say it in that way, like, that there's only four spaces. I can't imagine, like, if there were 20 spaces, like, it would, like, it doesn't sound right.
it might be a little chaotic.
Yeah, exactly. Like, just in terms of the place, and
mm-hmm.
and it feels like it's a nice ratio to the town population.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we have talked in the past about trying to expand it somehow, you know. We've had great ideas about having a foundry or,
right.
you know, some adding on in the back with workshops, you know, workshop space.
Right.
We could have more space to do art. And connecting with Patrick and the Basin Creek Pottery, somehow having, you know, some connection with him, which we have had in the past when ceramicists have come and
right.
they have worked with him. But it's it takes a lot of energy and it takes money to run something like this, and you know we are still working on trying to purchase the buildings themselves. We just have a lease agreement with the owners, so you know, just I think since 9/11, the hurricanes, a lot of people have directed their donations to efforts like that, which are
right.
you know, totally honorable and all that, but it's really we have seen the effects of that.
Uh-huh.
You know? So it's a little harder to keep things going sometimes, but
I just know from like the non-profit world in New York, like it seems so much of funding is education based also, like I don't know if you find that around here, like if you have some sort of educational aspect,
mm-hmm.
like then there's more funding.
There's more funding available.
Rather than just like production or, which
mm-hmm.
it's curious.
Yeah, I think also if, you know, if we were an organization that was more geared toward working with children, we probably could find a lot more money too.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But that's not really who we are.
Right.
And that's, you know, and so I think in response to some of that, we've tried to create some programs that would generate interest and funding for, you know, three different programs that we've designed, and one's the American Indian Artist Program and the MFA program that we're working with now, and the Writer's Residency Program. So
what do you what are some of the surprises or the struggles? Like I imagine your job is really changes every month. You know? I mean, one, with personalities, but two, with just what processes people are working with.
It's so amazing to me, and part of it is like, partly I wish I had more time to be down here and visiting with people, but my job is only part-time.
Uh-huh.
And when I was living in Basin, then I could, you know, I was relating to the artists that were here more frequently. But I love seeing the different processes and just how motivated the artists seem to be when they come here. I mean, here they are. I mean, a lot of them, just like you, come from the big city, and all of a sudden, whammo, you're in this little, you know, rural town that's pretty redneck and, you know, and people just seem to get energized by that, mostly. We've had very few people that have kind of freaked out and had to leave, you know, because they couldn't handle it.
Uh-huh.
But the production of art has always really amazed me, that people can come and then they just sort of, maybe they wander around for a few days, kind of like trying to get used to everything, and then
right.
all of a sudden they just get immersed in their work. And they're firing off paintings if that's what they're doing, or they're writing 20 pages every day, you know, and it's pretty amazing.
Uh-huh.
But it's really nice to see that, because then you feel like you're really providing something, you know, something really wonderful to people who normally can't, or maybe, you know, can't find the time to do that.
Definitely.
You know, I mean, especially for yourself with children and.
Yeah. Well, for us, it's very nice that it is like family friendly, because so many residences, it's just you can't even bring your partner, let alone
mm-hmm.
a family, and so. I mean, that definitely sets a tone. I mean, within the
mm-hmm.
the place, like that acceptance of like. Larger like not the artist is solitary.
Right. Yeah.
Toiling away in solitude.
Yeah, we're very unregimented. I mean, we don't, you know, we have no rules and really no regulations other than, you know, respecting your other residents, you know, and sometimes, you know, we run into problems with that. Mostly everyone's pretty good around stuff. If they have problems, they talk to each other, they work things out, mm-hmm. you know, that sort of thing. But, you know, I think in some ways, I think sometimes not having, you know, like not saying stuff like, well, you have to produce this much or do this, and then you have to show it at the end, or you have to do this or that or the other thing. Sort of, I think it motivates people even more, and they don't feel this,
yeah.
you know, this need to have to produce,
yeah.
mandate to produce something.
Yeah, it's interesting. All these parenting books, and there's like some similarities just between right. this idea of like you have to do this to get this or whatever, like taking that away and just being like,
mm-hmm.
no, that makes a lot of sense. And also, then you might propose that you'll do this, but then you come and you see that because of the weather or whatever,
yeah,
you need to do this instead. And it's I think that's really
mm-hmm.
that's really nice. And how Claudia described when she was here, just like if people need to read and go for walks while they're here, like whatever they need to do. But obviously you leave and you've had this experience and it influences the work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for some people, you know, that's, you know, who we are doesn't work for them. They like something a little more, you know, regimented or formal. And I know I've had some people, you know, say, well, you know, ask me a lot of questions about the refuge before they apply, and then maybe they apply and then they realize that, no, maybe it's not something they really want to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I have had some people, you know, where it's like it's not formal enough for them somehow.
Hmm. Or maybe it's something to do with like a social, like I think a lot of the residencies, it's like that people think of it in a sort of networking sort of way of like, okay, who else am I going to meet and how's that going to help or affect or, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Because I know a lot of them, you know, you'll have your own studio space, whatever, work time during the day, and then you all come together for a meal at least one point in the day, so you have to socialize. And we don't, since we don't provide that, it's all up to whoever, the mix of people who are here, and some people come and they don't want to socialize.
Right.
They're here for a month and they just, you know, and they know they have to do a certain stuff and they just do it. You know,
right.
Some people, but mostly people are pretty social and, you know, want to get to know who their artist compatriots are, so.
Do you feel like the landscape, I just feel like this is such a hard place to not be influenced by that, but I mean, how, I don't know what my question is exactly. Yeah, it seems like such a hard, like I could see one could come just to have space and time.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems so impossible to not be influenced by the place. And I don't know if you have any thoughts on that or just...
Well, personally, I don't know how anyone could come here and not be influenced by...
Right.
You know, I guess it's like a microcosm of what you might find in the city, but it's just so much smaller. So you're just hit in the face with so many different types of people in town, plus, you know, you look out and you see just this beautiful landscape all around you, and it just seems so open and free, and you can walk out your door and go up in the hills and not see anyone, which is really different than a lot of other places. And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, anyone who's half interested even in the history of what's happened around here, there's so much you know, you can get so much from that that would influence your work no matter what you do, I would think.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, Mark has been reading this book, The Wobblies.
Oh yeah.
Do you know that?
And
It's really, I'm so glad he's reading it because I'm learning so much from him, like, talking about it. And it's fascinating, the mining history. It's really intense. And, it seems like a place of such extremes and a place of contrasts and like even just in the weather, you know, or
the weather is, you know, you wait 5 minutes and it's changed. And but you know, in I've been here for almost, well, let's see, about 32 years now. And when I first got here, you know, the winters were, I think, a lot harsher than they are now.
Yeah, I heard you say that the other day.
Yeah, they. I remember coming and, I remember spending half my life underneath this house I was renting with a little blowtorch trying to get the water pipes.
Oh, jeez.
But, you know, we've had 20, 30, 40 below for weeks on end.
Wow.
And a lot more snow than we're getting. I think that all started to change, you know, probably about 10, 15 years ago. It just seemed to start getting warmer. We know if we get any below zero weather, it's only lasts for a few days.
Really?
And we don't get near the snow that we used to get. And you know, whether that is global warming or a combination of just cycles and global warming, I truly believe it's global warming. But I also think there's cyclic things that happen in nature and the weather and stuff that, and it could all be just combined as part of all that, but so it's really changed. And so, you know, yeah, going from you know, huge flooding of Basin Creek, which knocked both bridges out on either side of town in the early 80s, like 1980.
Oh wow.
This was before the highway came through.
Uh-huh.
And so Basin was isolated for a few days
because
you couldn't get in or out.
Uh-huh.
And you know, and then to 2000 when the fires were raging all around us.
All right.
You know, and it felt like you were living in a war zone, you know. It was really wild.
Wow.
So, yes, there are, you know, very intense extremes and contrasts for, you know, with any season. I mean, it seems like it's, you know, the 30 and 40 below sometimes that we used to have would go on for weeks. And, I mean, you know, people would just pitch in and help each other with stuff because, you know, you couldn't get your car started or whatever. So, you know, whoever could get their car vehicle going, you'd all pile in and go to the store, you know. And bring sleeping bags with you and, you know, in case you broke down.
Oh, jeez.
So, you know, it's...
And what was your path? Like, how did you end up here? I know you said you're from New Jersey originally.
Yeah, I grew up in New Jersey. And it's pretty wild that I am all the way out here. But my sister came out in, well, she went to Colorado first, and then she ended up in Montana because she'd met a friend who lived actually in Boulder. And when they ran out of hippie communes and stuff to do, she said, oh, I know a place where you can always get a job. And this was at the Boulder, it's called the Boulder Developmental Center now, but it was the Boulder River School and Hospital back then. And you could always, you know, get a job as an aide. And so she ended up there, out there, and I was just finishing up high school, basically. Well, I'd been out of high school for a few years, and I'd been out to visit, I think, once or twice before that, and I really liked it. And I was, I think, living up in New York State. I went between, after graduating from high school, New Jersey, New York State, and then back to New Jersey, and I worked for, I think, a year in New Jersey as a postal carrier in my town.
Uh-huh.
And I saved up enough money and bought a truck and loaded it up and came out, and I never looked back. And my youngest brother was going to school in Moscow, Idaho, and he quit school. Can't remember if he was a sophomore or what, but he quit school and came over, and then we both ended up renting a house up the creek for $75 a month.
Oh, wow.
So, and then I ended up buying the house for, I think it was like $3,000.
The building next door?
Next to the school.
Oh, next to the school.
Yeah.
I'm buying the house.
Up there, it was up the creek. And then at some point in time, it sold for close to $100,000, like some years back.
Wow.
So things really have, which was a complete outrage in town, of course. Everybody thought it was crazy, which it was. It was nuts, I mean.
Uh-huh.
But, so that's how I ended up out here. And I realized that this is where I should be. That New Jersey and New York just weren't for me at all, so. That's kind of where I came from.
Yeah, I also told Claudia how impressed I've been since being here, that meeting people in Montana in general, people seem very much like this is where I should be, which is unusual to go someplace. And it's usually, there's always this sort of like, oh, well, I had wanted to be such and such place, but then I got this job, and so I'm here, and it's usually some conversation kind of like that, or comparing what the place could become, like, oh, well, we would like it to be more this, or like there's always this sense of wanting something that isn't already there. And I think this is the only place I can think of where I just haven't encountered that. We met one person, and she said Montana is where she wants to be. She doesn't know that right here is where she wants to be, but that Montana is.
Yeah.
And she's the younger person. And I was, and that's the only person that there's been any sense of like
wanting to move on or do something different,
or just that it might not be able to happen here. And but that Montana is the place. There's something like really profound about that, you know,
because most people that you meet in like in New York are sort of, this is just where they are because they have to sort of be here or be
I feel like New Yorkers, I mean not all New Yorkers, but I feel like a lot of New Yorkers, like that's the place, like it's like this is the place for me, like I can't imagine. But then there's a certain amount of transience there. But I guess just traveling in general, or I think of where I grew up in California, it's like there's always this sense of, yeah, that it could, there, this place could become something else, or like this desire for something else. And I think New York is like kind of like Montana, New York City at least, like this place of such extremes and contradictions, that there's something similar, even though it's so totally different, that like people who choose to stay there really, really like that. But then there's a lot of like, you know, longing for, also a discussion of longing for wanting more space or whatever it may be from the city.
I can, you know, as I get older, for me, you know, when I go to, for me it's people. It's too many people in the urban areas that just totally, I can't handle that anymore. I mean, even my transition from Basin to Helena, which is puny, it's still being a transition for
it's
me.
It's not puny. It's very different.
It is very
it's
different.
It's very different.
And I I'm so glad that I live in a neighborhood that's, you know, pretty cool. Like, people are really friendly, and everybody talks over fences at each other, and, you know, and that feels good to me, but I'm still not totally used to it, you know. And,
yeah.
I like the fact that when I lived here, I could just do whatever I wanted and go out and walk up into the hills and really not see anyone. And I've actually, a few times I've gone for walks out up behind my house in Helena on Mount Ascension, and I haven't seen anyone, but it's really rare, mm-hmm. you know. But it's, you know, Basin is, I don't know what it is. I mean, you know, I don't know, maybe it's after being here for so long, for 30 years, and you just start to get set in your ways and used to something, and, you know, you don't want to change it. It feels comfortable, you know. So, but I can't imagine really living anywhere else.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I can sort of if it was like, you know, a little cabin by a creek somewhere. On a lake or something where I had a great view of the Beartooth Mountains or the Crazy Mountains or someplace like that. But, you know. But Dayton is truly a unique place, I think, although I don't feel like I know half the people that live here anymore.
Right. Has it changed?
I think it has changed quite a bit. When I first came here in 1974, well, there were a few more buildings up, you know, along the road in here. If you see the old historic pictures of the town, and actually there's one down in the office, you can see where there was, you know, buildings like we're in right now, that line, both sides of the streets up and down.
Mm-hmm.
They've all since been torn down, burned down, you know.
Right.
A lot of them have, you know, caught on fire and burned down. But what was my point now?
The changing.
Oh, yeah, the change. When I first came here in 74, downstairs, there was a big sign that hung off the front of this building here, and it said Hicks's Fountain,
mm-hmm.
General Store, something like that. And I would go in, and there was a long, bar, you know, with stools, and you would sit at the stools, and I would eat Eddie's Donuts and drink coffee, and I met all the old people in town. The older people would go down there and hang out and have their morning coffee, and they were. There were some of them had worked in the mines up in the mountains, and they were characters. They were, you know, they were really, they had a lot of stories, and they felt like really, like real genuine people to me. Like, they didn't care who you were, really. They,
mm-hmm.
they cared, you know, what kind of a person you were. If you were a good person, that's
right.
What they cared about. They didn't care anything else, really. They didn't care what color you were, what sexual orientation you were, or anything. They just, you know, if you, and they liked seeing what the younger people were doing in town. They were fixing up their places. They were, you know, making them look nicer. They were taking an interest in the town, which I guess there'd been a real, you know, kind of like a period of time where no one was really caring much about town. It was like an influx of younger people, hippies, the bikers, although I don't know how much the bikers contributed,
uh-huh.
except for a few good bikes in the bar every once in a while to liven things up in town. And then the artists that were here, and then the little odd group of lesbians that ended up in Basin. So they were all just, they felt to me like they were real, they were friendly, they were open, and but then their generation, their kids grew up, and they, to me, weren't as friendly, you know.
And did they stay generally, or did that generation leave?
They mostly stayed, these
mm-hmm.
kids did. They're all, you know, there's some old families in town that have been here forever.
Mm-hmm.
And they've all, you know, I'm thinking of, you know, one and two in general that have all either ended up living in and around Basin or in Boulder,
mm-hmm.
Boulder area. Yeah.
And what do people do generally hear, or I guess you can't really say that, but like in terms of industry or where, like, are people, how are people generating income or like in Basin?
Well, I know some of them used to work in the mine in Boulder, in Butte, when it was open. I think that probably state government, a lot of people work at the developmental center in Boulder.
And is the developmental center, it's not the youth correctional
facility? No, that's new. That's a fairly new institution. Some people work there too.
Right.
No, it's for developmentally disabled people, and that's been here since, forever.
Uh-huh.
I can't remember when it was built, but it used to be huge. They used to own, have a farm where, because they had to hire functional people, and then they switched all that around and farmed all those people out to group homes.
Mm.
But they had, a farm where they grew their own food.
That's so cool.
And they stopped all that.
They stopped all that.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
I know.
That seems so fundamental.
I know. But that has employed quite a few people in the area. And I think people that live here mostly just don't make that much money.
Right.
There's a few. And then some of them have, heavy equipment businesses. Or they've been loggers or something like that, But most of them don't. I don't know what they do, I don't know now what they do,
Right.
Maybe they sell drugs, I don't know.
Right.
or they're on disability.
Do many people commute, to Helena?
Some do. Uh-huh. I know some do. I don't know how many, but...
a few people tell us that they work at the hot springs, and...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just curious, any place you go, how people...
I know, make a living and survive.
People make a living, and then it's one of the greatest things about traveling is just learning, remembering that people live so many different ways.
Yeah.
And are happy so many mm-hmm. different ways, and and it's not like in New York you can say everybody does
mm-hmm.
a specific thing, but somehow it's more of a question
right.
here, so how do people get to live here?
How do they survive?
Make it work?
Well, it's interesting. I always have, I feel like, I drive through communities and I think, I wonder what people do here for a living. It's silly because they probably do the same thing that, happens in Basin, every
right.
day. It's like, and I suppose if I had a great desire to make a ton of money, I would have never come to Montana.
Well,
there's not much here. And I know some of my siblings back east said I would, thought I was crazy for moving out here. And
how many siblings do you have?
Well, I have five altogether.
Wow.
So I have a brother in Maryland and then a sister in Michigan. And those two make over $100,000 a year, and they're overweight and stressed out. And then there's three of us out here.
Your other brother stayed. That you lived with.
Yeah, he stayed. He actually lives in one of the more remote areas of the state, in the Big Hole Valley.
Uh-huh.
It's so beautiful down there, but it's very remote. And he does contract work, and he loves it, and he's out in the woods all the time.
That's great.
Backpacking, skiing, whatever,
Yeah.
But none of us out here, my sister or I or he, have ever, made a ton of money, and that's fine with us.
Yeah. choosing to make art, whether it's in Montana or New York City, okay.
Maybe it's easier out here just because, perhaps maybe rent. I know rent isn't probably as much as in New York.
Definitely not. It's something that I've been thinking a lot about lately, and it comes up for me here because people I meet, they talk about not having computers or whatever, and it's mm-hmm. like,
whoa.
Yeah, exactly. But I just think in terms of a time period that we're living in, you know, there used to be apartments in New York in the 70s for $75 a month. Like, the woman who sounds funny, the woman who helps do our taxes, she said that in the 70s she drove a cab, and she's probably in her 50s. Mm-hmm. And she, in the 70s she drove a cab two nights a week, and then she wrote, you know, the rest of the week, and that was enough money to survive. And mm-hmm. And you just can't do stuff like that anymore in the city. Like, you have to have two jobs. And,
well, you can't even really do that here.
Yeah, exactly. Anywhere. And it just made me think of, you know, things are so, expectations are so different now in terms of, like, having disposable wardrobe,
you used to just have what you have,
that's fine, and like you maybe get something when something wears out, but now there's like this sort of constant need for like
more.
Just with a computer and like an iPod, and then you have to buy like all the accessories, and mm-hmm. like it's like all these things that are, at least in urban culture, they're kind of like expected things. Like most people want and they're very expensive things, and
yeah,
and I don't know. I think about that.
Yeah.
You know, and how is that, like, is that going to keep cranking up? And in some ways, there's something really lovely about thinking about, well, I don't need those things, because we really don't, but...
No. We think we do.
Yeah.
Well, and it depends on what you do for a living, you know, too. You know, in a way. I mean, if you need it or not.
Yeah.
Know. I mean, when I first came here, I think I had $4,000 in my pocket, and I lived easily on that for a whole year. I probably had some left over.
Right.
I mean, that's how cheap it was back in 1974 and 75. You know,
right.
It was really cheap. And so I think, you know, I remember phone bills being hardly anything, sewer and water bills being like a few bucks a month.
Right.
You know, and now everything's changed. And so even if you do want to hang around a little bit, it's harder now. You almost have to work, and especially with minimum wage, if you have that kind of a job. You're working all the time just trying to pay basic bills.
Yeah.
But people seem to do it, and I don't know how they do it. You know, you see them driving around in brand new cars, and I always wonder how they're doing it. You know, how are they up to their eyeballs in credit, or and that's what some people have said, that we're just a whole society that's living on the edge all the time.
Right.
So, and I should talk, because you know, I went to school, and that was all. I'm still paying school loans.
Oh yeah, forever. I'll be paying. It's just the part I accept. Just. Once a month, forever.
So.
Yeah.
But yeah, it seemed like to me back then it was a lot more relaxed, and we had more time to have fun and just relax and do fun things, you know. We would all get together and go out and help each other get firewood. And then we'd come back and we'd play music in the alley down here, and we'd drink a whole bunch of beer and just have fun. And play music and sing, and then maybe throw a potluck dinner together. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It was good. Or we'd all pile in the trucks and go up Basin Creek to our swimming hole and jump in.
Uh-huh.
Those kind of things don't happen anymore.
Yeah.
You know, we just don't. I mean, yeah, we're all in our, you know, those of us who are still here are in our 50s, and Those that, you know, going out and getting wood isn't something we can just jump up and do anymore. But the finding the time to do the other stuff,
right,
and relax is somehow that's all changed. And I don't know if the younger generation has that kind of time these days.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I just think things are
really
so
bad.
Complicated.
Yeah, I feel bad for younger people then that don't have that kind of didn't have that experience, because that felt like an extension of my childhood.
Yeah.
You know, the first few years being out here, being able to do that.
Yeah.
But it all changed when Ronald Reagan got elected. The whole tenor of the country changed then, back in the early 80s, I remember.
Yeah.
When he was elected, so. Yeah.
Well, how do you feel, like, in terms of politics in Montana? Is that also a set of contrasts? And it seems like there's some. I don't really have a sense of. I know that John Tester just won, and
mm-hmm.
that people are excited about that, and that it seems like a good thing. But I don't know, like, beyond mm-hmm. that much. And
well, probably. I mean, the state legislature has been a very conservative Republican legislature now for the past at least 10 or 15 years. And that's been really hard on education and the arts, and in terms of funding for that kind of stuff, and also for, you know, low-income people in the state. But education especially, because they cut funding. Because that's the time when I went, I started school when I was 45. I started college.
Wow.
No, I was 39. I graduated when I was 45.
Wow.
And I just remember my Pell Grant paid for just about everything the first couple of years. And then every year I had to, you know, it stopped paying for a lot of things. And then I ended up having to take loans out to pay for everything else. And plus I worked.
Right.
I had a job. So, and that, in my opinion, was, well, I know for a fact that they cut so much funding to the schools, to the colleges, because the conservative legislators did not like the schools. They didn't like their liberal, so-called, quote-unquote, liberal education
mm-hmm.
they were, you know, giving kids. So they just whacked away at stuff all the time. And so that grant money, and even the loan money that I got through all this, you know, federal crap, wasn't even that much money. But when it was all said and done, it was a lot of money, you know.
Right.
So what I feel about it now is maybe, who knows, maybe Montanans are sick of it, and the cycle is starting to change, because, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, I think it was a lot more liberal. That's when they passed the Constitution. That's our state Constitution is one of the most liberal in the country, and one of the most liberal and humanitarian, I think. And it's they've been whacking way at that, the Republicans trying to change those things. And so who knows? I don't know. I mean, finally we got rid of a Republican governors and elected a Democrat. And I don't know how good this guy is, but, you know, certainly he's doing better things already that I can see. And so we'll see. You know, I hope it's kind of swinging around again.
Yeah, well, it seems that there's that... I don't know if it's libertarian, like there's so many things that are close to liberalism, like, and it, Montana seems like one of those places where, like, liberalism, like, sort of closes around, or I think of with just Western in general, like that.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of gun culture, having its few governmental sort of
rules and
regulations exactly as possible,
mm-hmm.
but it's like it's really liberal to the point of where it becomes sort of
on the verge of anarchy.
Or
well, that's what the Republicans have been touting is less government, but they're all a bunch of hypocrites.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, they want less government, but then they don't want you to have abortions.
Right, less government, more
they
God.
They don't want you to marry someone of the same sex or even be with them. You know, so they contradict each other all the time. But
yeah.
I mean, a lot of the eastern ranchers in this state are pretty conservative people, but maybe they're more fiscally conservative than they are,
right?
Like socially, you know.
Right. I guess that's
Because you know, I grew up. My parents and I, you know, my parents were pretty low income, middle class, lower middle class, on the verge of working class, but my parents were Republicans, and I grew up in a Republican family. But that's when the Republican Party meant, you know, they were pro-choice. They weren't, you know, to my knowledge, against gay this or gay anything, you know. And they were more fiscal kind of conservative type people. You know?
Right.
But socially, my parents were really progressive, I thought, you know, in terms of, you know, they accepted a lot of stuff, it seemed like. But I think that, of course, well, the religious right took over the Republican Party, and that's where that went. So, and there is a fairly big element of that in Montana too, you know,
right.
The religious right. But I also think that some people are really starting to see where has that gotten us?
Right.
Nowhere really, you know. So it'll be, you know, maybe it is. Maybe it's on a swing that's going, and the pendulum's going back up, and it's changing. And I can only hope, because I don't see where we've gotten any good out of, you know, a Republican. So we'll see. You know, the past 10, 15 years of conservative Republicanism, and we'll see what the Democrats can do. Personally, I wish we had more than one party in the country, and we were a parliamentary type government instead of two party.
Yeah.
I think there'd be a lot more accountability then, perhaps. So. But.
Joy, what did you study when you went to college?
I got a degree in English.
In English?
Yeah. My emphasis was on creative writing, poetry. And one thing I'm finding is as the office and manager and court and the residency coordinator of the artist refuges, now I have no time to do my own art.
Uh-huh.
And it's frustrating to me. And, you know, it's my own thing.
Your own refuge.
And maybe it's because you just need a lot more money to live these days, just to even survive.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, the other days when I'm not here, I'm, you know, I have a gardening and landscaping business, and I work like a dog. And, you know, and you come home, and at 53, when I come home after doing a lot of physical work, I can barely move.
Uh-huh.
So it's rather exhausting. And then my dad passed away last year, and he was almost 90, and we moved my mom out to Helena. And so my mom's 86, and she's, you know, starting to slide, and so I spend a lot of time, you know, hanging out with her and doing stuff with her and helping her, and it's not that I mind it or anything. I really feel honored to spend the last years with her, but it's added a whole other dimension to my life.
Yeah.
So I sometimes dream about, oh, moving back to Basin into my little house over here on the side, having a few moments of peace and time to myself.
Yeah.
But that's not where my life is right now. So,
has your mother dealt with the transition from, was she in New Jersey?
She was in Maryland. Near my older brother. Yeah. Yeah, I think she loves it out here.
That's great.
And my only wish was that she could have come out sooner.
Yeah.
When she was a little more physically able and vital. I mean, she's always been a pretty vital person and just, you know, full of life and everything. And she's, I mean, up until like a year ago, she was playing tennis. And taking hikes and stuff like that. And now she's like really slowing down because of a severe case of arthritis in her spine. So it's really laid her back a bit. And she's not real happy with it. But I think she's dealt with it pretty well. But I can only imagine, you know, that generation always says stuff like, oh, this is, you know, oh, I'm, you know, they won't tell you anything, really. You know, and they won't say anything bad. You know, they'll just say, oh, I'm doing fine, honey.
Right. You have to interpret what
but
that
I can't imagine, I mean, I can only imagine that something like that on an 86-year-old, I'm sure it was in some ways really hard and stressful.
Right.
You know, to just start your life over again in a way. So.
Yeah. My grandmother is going to be 90 this year, and she, yeah, it's funny, it depends when you catch her, because usually it's like, oh yeah, okay, but then every once in a while something's really hurting, like then she lets you know how she really feels,
mm-hmm.
and you're like, oh yeah, you must feel like that all the time,
yeah,
and,
mm-hmm.
And how hard it must be to be just a nice person, you know.
They're rather stoic generation, usually.
Yeah.
Most of them anyways, you know.
Well, I guess how much time can you spend just... Yeah. I guess it doesn't have to be complaining all the time. But,
no.
but you could be clear, I guess. Yeah.
No, I think for the most part she's pretty happy. But, you know, this is what I run into all the time. Because I mostly garden for older people because those are the people who need help gardening. And they're a rather long, you know, a lot of them are lonely.
Yeah.
And so they'll walk around and follow you while you're gardening.
Uh-huh.
If they can walk, you know, and talk to you a lot, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I get, you know, you get this real big hit of, you know, that these people are lonely, basically.
Yeah.
And I know my mom is to a certain degree, and she's always been a very social person, so I thought maybe after a while she would make friends, but she hasn't done that very much yet.
Is she in a community, like a group, a retirement facility?
She's in an apartment complex that's run by Helena Housing Authority, and it used to be an all just seniors building, but now there's people with all kinds of disabilities there, plus senior people. And her biggest problem is she's can't hear very well anymore. And so that's one of the worst senses to lose. You feel really isolated.
Yeah.
Even if you can't see, you can still hear people. You can be in conversations with them.
Stories and, yeah.
But if she goes to meetings and stuff at her place, she can't hear anything. I'll take her to the movies. She has a hard time hearing the movies.
Wow.
With all the
instruments hearing aid
and
the
hearing things.
Yeah.
And she's got hearing aids, and it's just tough, you know.
Yeah.
She used to love classical music. She can't hear it the way it's all distorted, she said. Yeah. So all those things are really tough on her, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
And she doesn't complain too much about it. But.
And your gardening work, is that seasonal?
Yeah.
So in the winter time.
In the winter time, in the winter time, I try to do other things like paint. I used to be a house painter for a long time, so I try to find painting jobs and odd jobs like that. And, you know.
Physical.
And I think, you know, when I decided to go to college, I thought, okay, well, you can't keep doing this work for the rest of your life. And so maybe you should go get an education finally, you know, because I wasn't ready when I got out of high school.
Uh-huh.
And I always was really loved to write. And so I did that. And then I got a minor in environmental science studies.
Uh-huh.
And I thought maybe I could work writing, like for nonprofits, you know, with environmental stuff, that kind of thing. But when I graduated and I went out into that workforce, well, of course I was getting older. Even at 45, I wasn't real marketable, unfortunately, the way our society is.
Right.
I could find some work, but it didn't pay me enough.
Right.
I mean, one place where I apprenticed for a while, or did a little apprenticeship thing while I was in school, wanted to hire me for minimum wage, and I just said, "Are you kidding me?"
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm not. I can go out and paint houses for $15-$20 an hour, you know, and so I just couldn't do it. I can't live on that. So here's where I'm at, you know, doing physical work, but making, you know, decent money.
Right.
But it's not, you know, it takes its toll on me physically.
Yeah.
But maybe it'll make me stay younger. I don't know.
I think I'm sure. If you don't do anything crazy on the ladder.
I'm tired a lot, but, you know.
Honest, tired.
And I come down to the basin for a vacation. I work in the office. But I really love to garden. I love doing that kind of stuff. And I took a master gardening class a few years back, and I love it. I just love being outside doing that stuff.
Yeah. Well, it seems like like to go to like a sitting job from being outdoors. And I mean, I think of my cousin, or I think of the other women I know who do similar sorts of work, and it's mm-hmm. like she's turned 50, but she works for a company that PG&E contracts out, and she hikes all through the Sierras to make sure that power lines are not mm-hmm. being obstructed or I mean, she's amazing. You guys, I write her every day from here. I'm like, I think of you every day. Like you guys, all of you ladies, like there's things that remind me of her. Like she's really
mm-hmm.
outside, always moving,
mm-hmm.
whether it's on a horse or not on a horse. And
yeah,
she's a ranch too. Mm-hmm. But and like. An office job is just not really, it's just not.
Well, I have to crank my brain around sometimes pretty heavily when I, you know, like I have to crank it around and then get everything, I'll put in my car and I come down here and I walk in the office and I go, oh, you know, and I sort of rearrange everything.
All right.
It's tough. It gets tough sometimes. But this time of year is always really hard just because we've just gone through the annual Jazz Brunch fundraiser, and it's always a ton of work. So
yes,
and we're all exhausted from it. And I'm also I could also be working full time gardening now if I wanted to.
Mm.
I have so much work right
now. Right.
So you know, after this, you know, the first part of the season gets done with, then things start to slow down a little bit, and I have a little more breathing room. So, you know,
you need some, like, 13-year-olds that you can subcontract to.
Somebody with brawn.
Exactly. Like that energy.
Yeah. So, yeah, some kids who would want to work. It's hard to find teenagers or young adults who actually really want to work.
Yeah.
Or they want to work, but their idea of work and mine are really different.
Right. We've met Joe in Basin.
Joe with the mowing service.
Yeah, with the mowing service.
I just saw him drive by.
So a man named Bill down the street was really talking him up to us, like, he's a real go-getter, and he wants to work more than he wants to hang around, and it's cute, and Joe was just standing there. He was for like 45 minutes, very quiet, like just being talked about. It's funny.
I know, I'm really glad to see him doing that because, his family, I know he's had, you know, his dad had a real bad problem with alcohol, and I know that he quit, and so I'm hoping that, you know, and then I see him doing this instead of, you know, most of these younger kids here just hang around and do nothing and get in trouble and, you know, get into drugs, whatever. And he doesn't seem to be doing that, so that's great. Because I remember catching him behind the jail back here, smoking cigarettes when he was really young. I poked my head around there, and he was with some little girl, and they both looked up at me, and he went, "Oh, don't tell my dad." I said, "No, I won't." I said, "But really, you shouldn't be doing that."
Yeah.
I said, "That's bad stuff to do. You know, it really isn't good." I don't think he smokes cigarettes. I don't see him now.
So. Yeah. I always see him on a lawnmower.
Yeah.
But I don't know that I would recognize him otherwise. Because he's like a kid on the lawnmower.
Yeah. He's a cutie.
He's a cutie. Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
And
it's been great.
Yeah. And, I'll put it up and you guys can find it if you want.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
I like it. All right.
Now I'll come down and talk to you in a little bit because we actually have to talk to you about leaving.
Oh.
Because it's next week already, the end of the month. So.
I know.
Yeah.
Good.
All right. So we don't have to do that on the radio.
No.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Joy.
Okay, thank you.
See you in a bit.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Tune recorder.
Yay.
We have an old tune recorder camera.
We just made a trip down to
very little mine, I think. Cool. Where'd you get that processed?
In Bozeman.
Oh, good.
Yeah, Deb and I went down there to go to the co-op and get film processed.
Okay.
Go
to sleep, my darling, baby. Oh, baby, the moon smiles above. Cuddle closer, little baby. Oh, baby, you're my precious love. Oh, why do you sigh? The stars are shining bright. Stealing.
that was the Desert Sisters, Go to Sleep, My Little Darling. And I just wanted to say goodbye and thank you to all of the folks who talked to me on the radio today, Eric and Barbara and Joy. And it's a pleasure to get to learn more from all of them. So next Tuesday will be the last broadcast from Basin. And I spoke with Claudia Montaigne the other day, and I'll put up the archive from that. She's the executive director at the Artist Refuge here. She couldn't meet during one of the scheduled broadcast times. Briar from the High Note will be here on Tuesday, as will Liz and Ryan, who are a couple in town that we've met, and they seem to have some good thrifting skills and experience, and so they were going to talk about that. They have a small rummage sale shop that they run in town, and so it should be a fun day to talk about high altitude baking and thrift shopping and maybe birds some more. All right. Bye-bye.